California is in the midst of what is usually the peak flu season. The coronavirus, though, is getting quite a bit of attention. There is now a seventh case in California. On Insight, I'll talk with the director of the Sacramento County Health Department. He is Dr. Peter Bielenson. We'll talk about the novel coronavirus, as it has now been named, and we'll talk about influenza. Paul Kitagaki takes us through his award-winning book, Behind Barbed Wire. It's a book of then and now, of people who were interned during World War II, their stories, their experiences that they have rarely, if ever, told. Paul's been immersed in their experiences for nearly 15 years. Christian Kiefer set his latest novel in some of this history. His book is titled Phantoms. It traces the tangled fate of two families in Placer County. This is a powerful mystery. I'm Beth Ruyak. There's a lot ahead today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Coronavirus cases worldwide are now at over 43,000. That's in more than two dozen countries. There are more than 1,000 deaths. One more case in California was confirmed overnight, bringing the total to 7. There are cases in Arizona, Illinois, Massachusetts, Washington, and Wisconsin. We're going to bring this conversation, though, to Sacramento County, where influenza, the flu, is a more real and immediate concern for people right now. Dr. Peter Bielenson is joining us by phone. He's the director of the Sacramento County Department of Health Services. Dr. Bielenson, glad to have you back on Insight.
Thanks, Beth. Appreciate it.
So in Sacramento County, give me a comparison right now of concern and attention between coronavirus and the flu.
Yeah, I very much appreciate that. As you have been reporting, there have been actually zero cases of the coronavirus in Sacramento. We've had about 60 cases of intensive care unit admissions for the flu and 10 deaths in Sacramento County alone. And that compares to 25 million cases of the flu in the United States to date, 150,000 hospitalizations and 10,000 deaths all in the United States due to the flu. So right now, obviously, the flu is a much, much bigger problem. And we're still in the midst of the flu season, so it's important to get your vaccination.
What does this flu look like, or are there different strains showing up?
There are different strains. There's A and B. It's mostly A so far. That doesn't really mean terribly much as much as just getting the vaccine, because the vaccine covers three or four different strains of the flu. And so it's important to get the flu vaccine, even if it is not as effective as some might hope. It still reduces the severity of a case of the flu.
What does A look like in its onset?
A looks like B. It comes on as a sort of like hurts your muscle, gives muscle aches, fever, fatigue. It obviously affects older people and senior and those with chronic conditions more effectively, more efficiently than others. But it's a significant effect on human beings.
So there's a question here that applies to both flu and coronavirus, and that is, from getting the virus to being able to treat it to it causing death, what happens and why for some people and completely not for others?
Very good question. They don't really know too much about the coronavirus other than to know that the inflammation that it causes in the lungs causes the pneumonia and the shortness of breath and the potential hospitalizations or deaths. We're just learning more about, I guess it's called COVID-19 now, which is the novel coronavirus. It's also important to point out that when you hear the coronavirus, if you get tested for coronavirus in the general healthcare world, it is generally not testing for COVID-19. They're actually testing for a variety of coronaviruses, some of which cause the common cold. So having coronavirus in and of itself is not particularly dangerous. The only potentially dangerous strain is this COVID-19. And as you reported, there are only 13 cases so far in the United States in the entire country.
So is that the same as what we're now calling the novel coronavirus, separate from SARS, separate from MERS, the past coronaviruses?
Correct. It's the novel coronavirus. And the reason it's called coronavirus, a little hint, is because the virus looks like a crown. That's why it's called coronavirus. All right.
So what to do here? How to be watchful for flu or coronavirus? When to just stay home and take care of yourself? And when to decide to check in with a doctor?
So really the only reason to check in with a doctor is if you've recently been to Wuhan or potentially mainland China. If you have any of those symptoms of flu-like symptoms of fever, fatigue, cough, shortness of breath, those sorts of things. If you have been to Wuhan, China, or maybe mainland China, then you should report those to your doctor and talk to that, him or her first about whether you should come in and whether you should just be tested. If you have those same symptoms, the symptoms of the flu, it is, and you have not been to China, it is immensely more likely, almost infinitely more likely that you'd be affected with the flu. And you should use the typical preventive things like coughing into your sleeve, washing your hands frequently, avoiding others who may be sick, etc.
I think you should repeat the washing your hands and maybe the 20 seconds, which is about like singing row, row, row your boat three times while you're washing your hands.
Or going through the alphabet, you know, A, B, C, D, 20 seconds. Washing your hands frequently is very, very important for all infectious diseases, particularly the viral diseases, which these are, because antibiotics don't work against viruses. So the best way to prevent them is to prevent them from coming on board from the first place.
I am talking to Dr. Peter Bielenson. He's the director of the Sacramento County Department of Health Services. Again, to repeat, there are no cases of coronavirus, even suspected cases in Sacramento County. However, the flu is really raging. We're in the peak time of flu season in California anyway, aren't we?
Correct. February and March are the peak season. So it's not too late. It takes maybe a couple weeks to get full immunity from the vaccine, so it's not too late to get vaccinated, and I highly recommend it.
And would you do some myth busting? There is some idea that maybe while you're waiting for that immunity to kick in, the flu shot has other impacts in your body, depressing immunity or whatever. Would you clarify what's happening from the time you get that shot until you are immune?
It does not depress immunity. It actually increases immunity, which is the whole point of the vaccine. And it does not cause illness. It's a portion of the virus that is used that is not infectious, that is in the vaccine, and it does not cause the flu. So it is absolutely a safe vaccine to have, and I highly recommend getting vaccinated before the end of the flu season.
I'm going to jump back to coronavirus right now. The U.S. State Department has a do not travel advisory to China. So that's changing spring and summer vacation plans. It's shifting educational and study abroad plans. It's impacting business and tourism. Dr. Anthony Fauci talked to the Washington Post, Dr. Bielenson, and said, we're not past the point of containment, but in the United States, we are in the containment phase because we're identifying, isolating cases, tracing cases. Do you want to add to that information about where we are right now and where California is?
Yeah, we're certainly containing this situation. It may not be anywhere near as serious as it has originally sounded, because we, in terms of fatality rate, there are about 45,000 cases about total in almost all of them in China, and then 1,000 deaths. So you would figure that's about 2.5% fatality rate, right? But in fact, in most of these situations, whether it's MERS or West Nile virus or a whole bunch of things that have come up every 3 or 4 years, it turns out that there are often many, many more people who have gotten sick with this disease and have a much more mild effect and therefore have not reported it. So the mortality rate is probably not as severe as it appears right now.
The fear.
Just to say that it is probably appropriate that we're doing these kinds of quarantines, but it is having a significant amount of effect on the countries that are involved, particularly China. And so as soon as we find out that this does not hopefully have as severe a mortality rate as it seems to right now, people will become more realistic about the illness.
I'm sure doctors' offices are getting those calls from people who have travel scheduled and asking, can I travel? Can I wear a mask? Is that safe enough? And what about domestic travel versus overseas travel? What's your guidance?
Domestic travel is absolutely fine. The only overseas travel I would recommend against, and it is actually required, is not going to mainland China until we've learned more about this disease. And thirdly, the masks that you see, the paper masks that people are using, are basically not useful at all, unless there are N95 masks, which you may remember was what we were talking about using during the fire season a couple years ago or a year ago. Those masks are fitted for people's faces and actually make a difference. These paper masks really make very little difference.
All right. Is there anything else here that you want to add that I might not have asked about that's important for people in Sacramento County, Northern California area to know?
These types of illnesses come up every 3 to 4 years. They get a decent amount of media hype, although you're doing a very good job of controlling that. And very importantly, again, the flu is by far the most significant communicable disease in our region at this time. And we need to make sure that people wash their hands, sneeze into their crooks of their elbows, throw tissue paper away if they've used it, and get vaccinated.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Bielenson.
Thank you.
That is Dr. Peter Bielenson, the director of the Sacramento County Department of Health Services. We have posted links to a number of stories related to both the flu and coronavirus. Those are at capradio.org/insight. Here's a programming note. NPR special coverage of the New Hampshire primary will start this evening at 5 p.m. You'll hear it on Cap Radio. For the rest of the hour, we're going to focus on World War II and a time of Japanese internment. Photographer Paul Kitagaki joins me after a short break. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Paul Kitagaki Jr.'s work as a photographer has taken him all over the world to see people and places that have been new and surprising and meaningful to him and many other people, in fact. But for nearly the past 15 years, he has been tapping into history that enveloped his own family. He's examining the lives and the experiences of Japanese Americans during World War II. Out of that research came a traveling exhibit. You might remember it. We've talked about it on Insight. It's titled Gambatte, Legacy of an Enduring Spirit. And then this past September, he released a beautiful book titled Behind Barbed Wire. It received a second place award in the 2019 International Photography Awards Professional Documentary Book. And I'm very happy to have Paul back with us in the studio today. Welcome.
Oh, thank you, Beth, for having me.
Let's start with a little bit of the history and the number of people who were removed from their homes in that time period of March to August of 1942.
Yeah, there was over 110,000 Japanese Americans that were taken forcibly removed from their homes. And the really interesting thing is two-thirds of them were American citizens.
We're coming up on an important anniversary of that time with the date February 19th.
Yeah, President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066 on February 19th, 1942, which forcibly removed all the Japanese Americans from the West Coast states. That would be California, Oregon, and Washington.
Your personal connection to all of this was through your parents, your aunt, your family members, but this wasn't something that you knew growing up. They didn't talk about it, did they?
No. I mean, like so many, I'm a Sansei, third generation Japanese American. Like so many of my generation, our parents really didn't speak about this. And so many of the subjects that I've photographed and interviewed their parents, they wanted to know what their parents had spoken about too. So it was a common theme and really interesting.
So let's talk about what this book does. You just alluded to it. I call it a then and now. And the then was history found in a lot of photographs. And the now is the way you tried to complete the story.
Yeah. So what's really interesting, all the Japanese Americans had a had to wear a tag with a number. So everybody is really reduced to like a number. And when I first learned about this, I was in 10th grade, and I was taking an American history class in San Mateo. And I was really shocked because my parents had never, you know, they never talked about this. And I wanted to know more. And even when I confronted them, not confronted, but, you know, asked them what happened, they just said, well, we went to these camps. It was cold. The food was bad. But they really didn't speak from the heart and how it affected them and their family. So I later found out that my uncle told me that Dorothea Lange had photographed our family, and she was like one of my photographic heroes. So when I was in Washington, D.C., there's the National Archives, and I searched through these boxes of photographs of Dorothea Lange, and I call them shoe boxes, but they're, you know, they're little 4x5 pictures of her, and on the back's a caption. And most of the captions had like no names, no identity. It would have a place and a time, but we wouldn't know who the people were in the photographs. So later on, I found this book that was called Executive Order 9066, put out by the California Historical Society in 1972. It was like the first book that really gave a visual presentation of what happened. Mm. And those images are so iconic, and a lot of them were Dorothea Lange's images. And when I was back at the National Archives, I really wanted to know what happened. I saw these faces, you know, staring up at me from the boxes of pictures, and I really wanted to know their story, and maybe I could have a complete picture. Maybe I could fill in some blanks about my family and the whole Japanese-American experience.
The picture of your family was in those boxes, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It was in one of the last boxes I found. It was a picture of my grandparents and my dad and my aunt. And then there's this white lady was leaning over at him, and my grandparents are smiling. I'm like, why is my grandparents smiling? Why are they smiling? It's not a happy time. And later on, I learned to find out that was her family friend, Dorothea Hightower, and she'd come to say goodbye to them. And her family had also stored a lot of their personal belongings when they were sent away from Oakland, California.
That picture is on page 60 in your book. And this is a great example of what you've been able to do in capturing words and photos, because on page 61, they have returned Kimiko and Kiyoshi, who is Paul Kitagaki, who's your dad, has returned to the site in Oakland. Tell me the story about working with them and piecing this together.
Once I had the historical photograph, I had to really figure out where the exact location was where all the Japanese Americans were rounded up. There's also two other pictures of my Aunt Kimiko standing by the luggage. And there's also another picture of my Uncle Nobu, who started a library in the Tanforan Assembly Center, which was in San Bruno, California. But this is like one of the first photographs I did. And it was really kind of cool because this is like a place that we'd drive by all the time in Oakland, because we'd go to the Chinatown there. It was near Chinatown. And the Oakland's Buddhist Temple, which is where they stored my family's belonging too. They and my family lived back there when they returned to Oakland from the camps. But to learn that spot was still there and bring my dad and my aunt in the same spot, it was really pretty incredible to have them standing there. I'm not sure if we all knew the significance of it at the time, but it was just really maybe a full circle thing, coming back full circle.
But that's what you did over and over in this book, is you took a moment in time from 1942 or somewhere in that area and then brought people back to a place, a connection. I can only imagine how powerful that was for them, for you, how it opened you, how it opened them. I'd like to hear more about that.
One of my subjects, Mason Tachibana, he was from Los Angeles, but he spoke about how when he was a child, they went to this Japanese Catholic church in that Los Angeles called Mary Knoll. And he goes, that was like one of the happiest times of his life. He would go there, but the reason why he went there was his dad wanted him and his sister to learn Japanese, how to speak Japanese. So that's where they went. He goes, it was really a happy time. But he said when they had to leave to go to Manzanar, in the camps, he goes, it was just like one of the most heartbreaking times of his life. He couldn't believe all this had happened to him. And he got really emotional. He brought up all these feelings that he had long lost buried. And he got very emotional during the interview. And he was very apologetic. I said, no, it's okay. But he ended up later on in life becoming a social worker. And mm-hmm. I asked him, is that, you think that because of that experience of other people helping you and your family after the war, that might have contributed? And he goes, yeah, maybe it could have happened, you know, been part of his journey that helped him.
Can I take you back to 10th grade when you were still awakening to what this was? Did you put that together from reading yourself? Did someone ask you? How were classmates? How was the teacher? What was that awakening?
I think as I can remember, it was 1970, and I think there's only like one paragraph in the history book, right, about this experience. And I was really shocked, and I was really hungry for more information. I think at the time, there's one other book at the time called Americans Concentration Camps. So I was really hungry for more information because my parents weren't talking about it. And I was kind of like, how can they do this to them? They're American citizens. How can this happen in America? And that at the time, that was because people were really not talking about this, that their generation, the Nisei, the second generation, they really didn't speak about that. They just held everything inside themselves. So it was really hard to find out more information. But
you were aware that family members had been in a camp.
So, yeah, we like, let's say when we're a kid, we go to the grocery store, like the Japanese grocery store in San Francisco or San Mateo, and my parents might see somebody there. And that their common question for that generation, hey, what camp were you in? And so, you know, you say, oh, and I was a Boy Scout, right? An Eagle Boy Scout. I'm like thinking, and, you know, we go camping. And I'm like, oh, camping's got to be fun, right? And that was their common thing, but it didn't register with my brain at the time because I'm just a teenager. I really didn't know that they were put in these concentration camps, incarceration camps.
So then in 10th grade, you realized that it was a much different camp than you understood.
Yeah, and since then, it's always had this burning thing inside of me. I wanted to know more. I wanted to be able to tell their stories, not just my family stories, but the whole, you know, Japanese community story. I wanted to have a whole body of work that would, because everybody's, there's rich people, poor people, people that are treated well, people that weren't, people that lost everything, people that had people from the community help support them and they had something to come back to. There's so many different kind of people. So I wanted to learn all that and put that together as a, you know, total story on the experience. And personal too, because, I mean, you see the photographs, but you don't know who they were. And now we've put a name in a sort of a personal history of that each of the family in those historical images.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Paul Kitagaki Jr. His words and photographs are in what is truly a stunning and powerful coffee table style book. It's titled Behind Barbed Wire, Searching for Japanese Americans Incarcerated During World War II. Words matter. And you chose incarcerated over interned.
Yeah, there are so many different terms. I mean, I even asked my subject, what was it? Because the official government term was called a war relocation center. And then they, through most of my life, everybody said internment camp. But other people have said incarceration camps. Some of my subjects said prison camps. Some said concentration camps. So there's so many different words for the same thing that would happen. And it was just, so I chose in incarceration camp.
Because?
From some of the community, the Japanese American Citizen League, they did a whole new vocabulary of the words, the meanings of words, and trying to get things changed instead of internment camp. And that was the word they felt was the most proper word to use.
So does using the word internment minimize to some Japanese Americans the experience that they and their family members had?
I don't know. If you talk to most of the people in the second generation, my parents' generation, the Niseis, most of them will say internment camp or they'll just say camp.
Mm-hmm.
But then some of my subjects, they said it was a concentration camp because we were behind barbed wire. There was guns. The guns were pointing, guard tires were pointing into the camp, not outside of the camp. So who's protecting who, you know? So there's some of my subjects who said, yeah, it's a prison camp or a concentration camp. They go, it wasn't like in Europe where they you had the death camps where they put everybody, but you're still locked behind barbed wire and you had no rights.
We talked previously in 2015 about your exhibit, Gambate, Legacy of an Enduring Spirit. And I guess it had a five-month run at the Japanese American Nation Museum in National Museum in Los Angeles. There are also images, or at least one, that was part of an exhibit at the Smithsonian. I remember you talking about a poster. And I remember seeing the poster that had a number of faces, people that you were still looking for, faces from a photograph.
Yeah. You know, when I first started the project, it started here in Sacramento.
Right.
I had a poster board with maybe 15 of the iconic images, and I took them to the Japanese Buddhist temple for the summer bazaar. And I thought, oh, somebody's going to recognize some of these people because they're from Sacramento. And I got not one call. So then somebody said, hey, you need to go to this Japanese Methodist church in Sacramento because they do this lunch for all the seniors. So I took the same board down there, and then somebody recognized somebody and went in the photograph. So it started from there. And it's grown since when we had the first exhibit at the California Museum in 2015. I had maybe 30 pairs, historical and the contemporary photographs. The exhibit that we just have, or my current exhibit, has 60 people. So it's really grown, and we're still looking for more places to exhibit that work.
You are using a special black and white film and a large format camera so that you have the look of the photographs taken by Dorothea Lange and others.
Yeah, I thought it was very important to shoot with film and a 4x5 camera, film camera, which is kind of the same sort of format they used back in the 40s, because I wanted the pictures to feel the same, have the same kind of feeling, even though they were taken here over 70 years later. I want them to kind of have a marriage, a match of before and after. So you weren't shot, you know, I just wanted that marriage of that to come together.
One of the stories was repeated by some of the people, folks who were jailed after the attack on Pearl Harbor. And Jimmy Yamaichi?
Yamaichi,
yes. Was one of the draft resistors who ended up on trial. Will you tell a bit of his story?
Yeah, Jimmy, he ended up in Tule Lake, which is where the segregated camp is, which is his brother was drafted in the Army. So his brother was already serving in the U.S. Army. But Jimmy felt that he was locked behind barbed wire, and he felt that his citizenship rights were taken away. So when this thing came out for the draft, he said, no, I'm not going to go draft unless you're going to let me out and return home and restore my rights. So he and a few other guys had to go to a trial in Eureka, California. And he argued to the judge that we're locked behind barbed wire. We don't have our rights. And we don't have freedom of choice. And so the judge agreed with him and dismissed the charges against him, which was unlike there's 63 guys in Heart Mountain, Wyoming. Mm. The same thing. They resisted the draft. And the judge there threw them in a federal prison. So they were in federal prison until way after the war ended for draft resisting.
A number of people you spoke with, and I think this is a really important point, Paul, express concerns that they don't want what happened to them to happen to anyone else. But there have been and continue to be times of mass hysteria in our country. There are times when groups of people, we all know it's contemporary, have been isolated or segregated, pushed out or pushed in different directions. What about this persistent desire to never have this happen again?
Yeah, mostly every subject I spoke to said they want to speak out about this because they want people to know the story. Because a lot of the story that the incarceration of the Japanese Americans during World War II, it's really not in a history book anywhere. It's hard for people to know this information across the country. I mean, we know it more on the West Coast, but, you know, people on the East Coast, the South, and Midwest, they really don't know the story. So they felt it's so important for them to speak out so this doesn't happen again. And even today, like last year, the Japanese Americans, there was a protest at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, because that's where they wanted to put some of the immigrant children separate from the families, and they put them. So there's a protest there, and then this June there's going to be a protest rally in Washington D.C. on closing the camps because they don't want people the same thing to happen to another ethnic group.
What do you want to keep doing with this history and the weaving of then and now?
Well, I'm still the book has come out, but last year I photographed 5 more people. I'm still looking for more people to add to the body of the work. I'm also trying to do another project with the campsites that I haven't started yet. So I'm trying to work on that, and I'm still trying to share the story more places, just be, you know, all across the United States and hopefully in other countries.
Let's direct everybody, even though we'll post a link to the website, to look for people that you're looking for and to help be part of this participation effort.
Thank you. My website's kitagakiphoto.com, KitagakiPhoto.com.
And you're still working at the Sacramento Bee besides all of that.
Yes, I'm still have a full-time job as a photojournalist. I've been a photojournalist for 42 years. I'm very lucky to have this life.
Well, thank you for staying connected with us as your work goes on. And this conversation will be linked on our website. Hopefully, it will move and be shared with people as well as this work that you've done continues. And I imagine it to be a lifelong project for you.
Thank you. Yes, it's definitely a lifelong project. And thank you for sharing the story.
Mm-hmm. That is Paul Kitagaki, Jr. His book is titled Behind Barbed Wire, Searching for Japanese Americans Incarcerated During World War II. You'll find those links at capradio.org/insight. And after a short break, we're going to continue the conversation about this era as Christian Kiefer talks about his novel Phantoms, which is set in Placer County, where he grew up. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. This is Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Japanese immigrants in the West from the early 1900s became vital to California's growing farm economy. Masakazu Iwatu wrote in the Journal of Agricultural History that by 1941, two generations, Issei and Nisei, were, quote, producing between 30% and 35% by value of all commercial truck crops grown in California, as well as occupying a dominant position in the distribution system of fruits and vegetables, both wholesale and retail. And this is where Christian Kiefer roots us in his latest novel, Phantoms. In Placer County, it's the early 1940s on the Wilson family farm where Hiro Takahashi and his family are vital contributors and their friends. So Dr. Kiefer, as I'll introduce him, is a professor at American River College and director of the Low Residency MFA at Ashland University. It's been a while. I'm so happy, Christian, to have you back on Insight.
Thank you so much.
This story happens in a place where you grew up.
That's right. Yeah. Auburn's my hometown. That side of Placer County is definitely where my roots are and where I still live.
The internment part of the story is before your life there. Why did you want to go there?
Well, growing up in that county, we did have internment probably briefly in our history books, maybe for a paragraph, but it wasn't really clear that that happened exactly where we live. And the more I researched it, the more profound it seemed. In fact, there was a turning point where I got some back issues of the Placer High School yearbook, and the yearbook editions from 38, 39 were probably close to 50% Japanese and Japanese American faces. Mm-hmm. After the war, there were maybe 6 or 8 Japanese faces in the whole book. Some of that can be ascribed to the opening of the Del Oro High School campus, but you know, what I found out is many of the people from Placer County who came back after internment weren't welcomed and moved on to places like San Jose and Oakland.
So this book opens with Ray Takahashi, Hiro's son, coming home from World War II. There's really no home at that point to come back to. And as you just said, there's some question about how much that was happening in Newcastle, in Auburn. But the book really changes from that point into our narrator who we meet next, John Fraser. What went on for you as a writer between that beginning and where we go next?
Yeah, my whiteness got in the way, essentially. I am not somebody who thinks white male writers need to be taking up space talking about race in this country. I think there's a good many topics white male writers don't need to be addressing. I think we could be listening a lot more and talking a lot less. Nonetheless, I'm a writer with only one idea at a time. So until I can get the idea out on paper, the next idea doesn't come. And I also felt really deeply engrossed in this story because it is the story of my home, and it's also kind of a shameful story about my home place. I wrote an opening chapter, close third, on Ray Takahashi coming home from the war, as you said, and then I decided I had no right to be that close to Japanese or Japanese-American characters. I didn't have the right to do that. So I flipped the whole script on it, and chapter two says, you know, I wrote that when I was, you know, 20 years old and just came back from Vietnam, and you're introduced to an entirely different narrator who's a white male wannabe writer who is trying to work on a book, and it allowed me to be fallible in my knowledge about Japanese culture. And it also allowed me to sort of acknowledge the privilege of whiteness in this country, which is a major theme of the whole book. You know, there's a conception that I had early on, which may or may not be true, but my thinking was if we had dropped, given the atomic bomb, we were able to drop it twice on Japan with probably very little feeling of guilt at the time. Would we have dropped two atomic bombs on Europe to stop the war? Like, I don't think so. I don't think white America would have done that, because what we do as a culture is we other Asia constantly. Edward Said calls it Orientalism, right? And it's this conception of Asia as other, which means we don't have to grieve in the same way for the other, right? So we've mostly transferred that feeling from the Far East to the Middle East now. But we still have this sort of sense of who we can grieve for and who we don't have to grieve for. And you see it even in news broadcasts when a nail bomb goes off somewhere and they make sure they tell you, like, and two Americans. You know, 57 people were killed, including two Americans, as if the two Americans make any difference at all. Except that's underscoring sort of our sense of who we are as a people. This kind of collective we, which is meant to be inclusive, but it's actually very, very exclusive, right? We Americans usually means in this country a particular kind of sort of white, heteronormative, often male person. And everyone below that is in some way other to a greater or lesser degree.
So John Fraser, the white man who has come back after the Vietnam War, takes us on this journey through what happened to these two families, one Japanese, one white, on this farm, how they were friends, internment divided and separated them. Then we're fast forwarded into really understanding the role of the two mothers and what happened to some of the children. But I want to say, through all of that, for me, Ray continues to be the lightning rod for everything I feel, everything I question about myself, everything I realize I didn't know and shouldn't have known. So in that way, something's accomplished that makes you set the book down and think, Where did I just go? Where did I just go?
Thank you. It's interesting you say that because in the structural conceit of the novel, Ray is theoretically the only character that John Fraser is making up whole cloth. He's, you know, the narrator is with Ray's mother,
right,
and with Helen Wilson, the matriarch of the White family.
That owned the farm where the Takahashis lived and worked.
Yeah, and it's really the story of a friendship that goes south for reasons of race, but it's also the story of a young man who comes back from Vietnam. He understands that he has been involved in the wholesale killing of an other people. I'm air quoting. You can't see me air quoting at home, but I'm air quoting. And he is trying desperately to not have to think about what he did in Vietnam, which was just he followed orders and he did what you do as a soldier. And in humanizing Ray, he's essentially trying to humanize his own experience in Vietnam to acknowledge that, yes, these faceless Asians that he had a part in killing in Vietnam were people.
I'm talking with Christian Kiefer. His previous award-winning novels are The Animals and The Infinite Tides. This is wonderful that you have a book signing and conversation event. It's happening this week, Thursday, February 13th, at the Public Library in Lincoln.
That's right.
At 6:30. So back to that topic of conversations where you as a white man think you have no business.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring up another one where you jumped right in. 5 books about mothers who are also human beings. This is an article that you wrote, and you do say, I would like to acknowledge that maybe it's problematic for a male writer to choose books about mothers. However, Phantoms, as much as it's about race and history, is about motherhood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about what a mother will do to protect herself, her children, and her family. It's about how one mother will face boldly another mother to say, what happened? What did you do?
That's right.
Why? And what came of it? And gosh, there are so many strong narratives in this book, and that's a super powerful one.
Yeah, the matriarch narrative in this book is fierce, and I can't quite recall how I came to it, but I knew pretty quickly that the mothers in the story, that it was really a story about the agency of women, motherhood, and access to certain kinds of power in terms of defining and defending who you think of as your family.
And these two mothers are Evelyn Wilson, who is the mother of the white family that owns the land, and Kimiko Takahashi.
Yes,
the mother of the Japanese family.
Friends. And the Japanese family and the white family in the book essentially work so closely together that the children and the husbands become sort of best friends to the extent that they consider each other family. Evelyn and Kimiko less so. Evelyn in particular is very distrustful about the whole relationship and the idea that somebody as other as this Japanese family could be considered family to them is kind of anathema to her.
They sort of hold the place for the bigger attitudes or stereotypes or fears of the country. And then ultimately, because I don't want to give away what happens, they end up being the power brokers in decisions that ripple out and affect every other family member's life in really shocking ways. This is actually a mystery. It reads,
yeah, kind of is.
The reveal comes at the end.
Yeah, and hopefully it's an inevitable reveal. I hope that by the time you get to the end, the reveal isn't a reveal. I hope you've relegated or prepared your heart for what's coming at that point.
Yes, it doesn't mean it hurts any less.
My mom called me in tears saying that the book just broke her. Yeah.
Yeah, I hope you gathered that from my summary too.
Yeah.
That you have to just sit with yourself for a while. Whose story is this? Whose voice do readers hear the most?
Well, the book ends with kind of a tacit acknowledgement of white narrative. John Fraser narrates this book, and the book ends with him. Mm-hmm. It ends with him enjoying his unearned privilege.
Of having been a witness and a weaver of history.
He's a witness to history. He also understands by the end of the book that he really wasn't actually involved in this story. You know, the models that I had were books like William Styron's Sophie's Choice, which is narrated by the downstairs neighbor, Stingo, who's narrating about Sophie and her boyfriend. And it's an amazing story, but he's not really involved in the narrative. And I liked that idea. I liked the idea of a narrator being as close to a story as you can get that's not really yours to tell, which is the whole, I think that's the whole issue with a lot of white writers sort of trying to cross that boundary. It's like, how do you cross that boundary in a way that's respectful? There's a huge controversy right now with American Dirt.
I was sitting here in my mind thinking about whether to bring that up, and I don't want the rest of our time to go there, but that is that same conversation.
That's the same conversation, right. And, you know, with my book, I wrote this book with my friends who are writers of color in mind. I sent it out exclusively to women and writers of color to get blurbs. If any of them had told me that I shouldn't publish it, I would have stopped for sure, because it's not my story to tell. And I think I did as good a job as possible in terms of the research and whatnot, but it's still research. You know, it's not lived experience.
Yeah, and it's deeply researched. Yeah. And I think we could continue for a long time talking about this book. Again, I'll encourage people to join you at the Public Library in Lincoln on Thursday at 6:30. We have a couple minutes left. I do want to talk about the fact that your youngest child has been in a really remarkable survival battle.
Yeah.
And you've been very public about it. If you would talk for a moment about Vivian Eden Kiefer, the little girl that came after six older brothers.
So number seven, our only girl. She was born with Down syndrome, heart defect, had open heart surgery at 6 months, which is not uncommon with Downs. Let's see, almost died of pneumonia the following winter, and then went into the hospital for many months and was finally diagnosed with pediatric pulmonary hypertension. So the thing with Vivian is she feeds through a tube in her stomach. We've got oxygen on hand all the time. She's a rock star, so she stays up till 5 o'clock in the morning, after which we all go to bed. The thing with having a child like that, and I'm sure certain listeners can relate, you never know if she's having an off day or if she's dying and we need to race down to Stanford Hospital. And that's just kind of like the daily stress. So my wife and I are checking in every day going like, how's Vivian doing? Like, oh, she seems a little off. Does she look pale to you? Does she look puffy? If she does, maybe her heart is beating out of rhythm, or it's beating too hard, or maybe fluid is gathering around it. Maybe her pulmonary hypertension medication isn't working. And so we've been traveling back and forth to Stanford, staying in hotels, staying at the Ronald McDonald House. As everybody in America knows, medical expenses, even if you've got good insurance, they still hemorrhage you out, for sure. So we've had some help with GoFundMe, people contributing and sort of helping us get sort of through the period. But it is ongoing. It's terrifying when I think about it, but mostly it's just kind of daily life, you know.
How old is she now?
She'll be 3 next month. Mm-hmm. And when I come home from here, all my clothes will go into the wash and I'll go into the shower, because if she gets sick, it's dire. Mm-hmm. So everything is like boiled. Yeah.
So that's the centerpiece of your life.
That's
the,
it.
The writing continues. The boys are all busy in lives. And
yeah.
You
Maniacs.
And your wife have this sort of interesting choreography.
Yeah, it's a feral house.
I think that it's remarkable. You've been so public about it. If people look on your Twitter feed on Christmas Eve, you posted a picture of just the kind of debris of all of her health care.
Yeah.
And I think it's an amazing real life story that you're sharing with everybody.
Thank you. Thank you. Mm.
So what are you working on next book-wise?
Oh, well, I tried to take a break so that my wife could take up more space in our lives.
Lovely.
Because I take up a lot of space. But I've come to realize that if I'm not writing, I don't have anything to do. Mm-hmm. So I accidentally started a new book, which takes place in the 1880s in the Amazon. So this is all predicated on me trying to get to the Amazon to do the research. But that's what's next.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, thank you.
It is a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks so much. So good to be back.
We'll make sure that the next conversation is soon, because life is fluid and it's changing fast for everybody.
Sure is.
All the best wishes to your family and little Vivian.
Thank you.
That is Dr. Christian Kiefer, and you can find links to more about his novel Phantoms at capradio.org/insight. Again, the public library in Lincoln, Thursday night to meet him at 6:30. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. NPR's special coverage of the New Hampshire primary begins live on Cap Radio at 5. Thanks for joining us.